literature tells stories. But what about the story of literature?
You know, here I had been studying literature for decades and teaching literature, and I thought I knew a lot. But then when about 10 years ago, when I really got into world literature, I realized just how little I knew, how much there was to discover. And I also realized that we don't look at the big picture of literature, that we don't tell the story of literature. And so this is what I started to do and explore and piece together that larger story. And that's really what led me to write the book.
That's Martin Puckner. We spend the hour with him talking about his fascinating look at the story of world literature. It's called The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. Published by Penguin Random House, the paperback version is coming out July 24th. That's on the menu today for Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour at this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. More than 4,000 years ago, the first story was written down. The Epic of Gilgamesh was written on stone tablets. Luckily, as you'll hear later, when my guest Martin Puckner tells us the story of how the epic was discovered. It's just one of the myriad fascinating revelations in his book, The Written World, a groundbreaking journey through time and around the globe to reveal the powerful role stories and literature have played in creating the world we have today. Puckner explores 16 foundational texts selected from more than 4,000 years of world literature. He reveals how writing has inspired the rise and fall of empires and nations, the spark of political and philosophical ideas, and the birth of religious beliefs. From Homer's Odyssey, the oldest written fragment of which was just discovered this week, to the Hebrew Bible and the teachings of Buddha, Confucius, and Jesus. From The Tale of Genji, the first great novel in world literature written by a woman, to another great woman storyteller, although perhaps fictional, Scheherazade and her 1001 Nights, and many more. The Written World also chronicles the inventions, like writing, the printing press, even the book itself, that have shaped religion, politics, commerce, people, and history. Martin Puckner is professor of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. His prize-winning books range from philosophy to the arts, and his best-selling six-volume Norton Anthology of World Literature and his Harvard edX MOOC, or Massive Open Online Course, have brought thousands of years of literature to students across the globe. Well, Martin Puckner, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
There is so much in this wonderful book that vastly expanded my knowledge about things that I thought I already knew a lot about. You know, certainly I know about the 1001 Nights, and I have read parts of the Iliad and the Odyssey and, you know, all the other great works of literature that you write about. But you are really telling stories about stories.
I think that's right. And, you know, the sense of discovery, thank you for saying that, by the way, that you experienced reading the book is the same I experienced in writing it. Because, you know, here I had been studying literature for decades and teaching literature, and I thought I knew a lot. But then when about 10 years ago, when I really got into world literature, I realized just how little I knew, how much there was to discover. And I also realized that we don't look at the big picture of literature, that we don't tell the story of literature. And so this is what I started to do and explore and piece together that larger story. And that's really what led me to write the book.
You talk about four stages of literature. So just as a way to kind of get the lay of the land, you know, without going too deeply into each of them, because we'll do that later on, these four stages are scribes, teachers, authors, and mass production. If you could just briefly describe each one of them.
You know, one of the interesting things about telling the long story of literature, all 4,000 years of it, so you realize that some of the figures we associate with literature, such as authors, are relatively recent arrivals. And in the ancient world, when scribes first started to write down stories, and writing wasn't really developed to write down stories, it was developed really for economic transactions, to fix economic transactions. But when some of these scribes started to write down stories, they cobbled together oral literature and slowly began this process of turning, you know, thousands and thousands of years of oral storytelling into writing. And that is really the first stage when, in different parts of the world, whenever writing develops, some of these oral stories get transformed by scribes into literature. And sometimes these are collaborations between scribes and oral storytellers. Sometimes it's really scribes who take over entirely, but there's always this oral storytelling tradition feeding it. And then some of these stories are declared sacred. That's a big rope. Plays a big part in my book. I think we're very familiar with the idea of scripture, to the extent that we can't even imagine, I think, what a religion would be without some sort of sacred text to back it up behind it, as at the foundation of it. But like all things, that had to be invented, and it was invented in the ancient world when some of the written stories, newly written stories, were declared sacred. And then I move on to these teachers you mentioned. I was struck by the fact that whenever written culture developed in different parts of the world, there also emerged before long these charismatic teachers like Confucius in China and the Buddha in India, Socrates in Greece, and Jesus in the Near East. And what they have in common, and I was really struck by this, is that they didn't write a single word. They lived in the most literate cultures of the time, but they rejected writing in favor of live, interactive teaching their students and followers. So they were kind of skeptics. They were Luddites, if you will. Though the interesting thing that then happened is that their students, after their teacher's death, students turned to writing and produced the texts that we now associate with these master teachers. So that's an important new stage and a new form of literature. And then, yes, slowly individual authors emerge, authors in our modern sense, authors who invent new stories, who sell these stories on some form of marketplace, who try to make a living by these stories, and who claim some form of ownership over these stories. Now, these modern authors did emerge before print, but it was really only in the era of print that modern sense of authorship came into its own. And yes, then we end up with the present, because the book was very much written as an attempt to figure out what's happening all around us. We're clearly living through another revolution in writing technology. The way texts are being written and read and distributed is changing, and that's also changing what kind of stories are written down. So in part, I tried to look at the prehistory of that, the 4,000 years and the earlier writing revolutions, to see what's happening now. So that's I think we're at the very beginning of this new age, of a new age of literature, and it will be very interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in our age, we talk about sending a text, which is a whole different definition of text than what one might be using if you talk about the Popol Vuh or the Bible.
Right. And it's interesting that for the first time, text has become a verb. It took a long time for that to happen. I think it's another indication that something really interesting and important, but also scary and different, is happening all around us. Though it's actually, I have in my book, I mentioned it only very briefly, a story, the oldest story really about the invention of writing. It takes place in Mesopotamia, and there's this king who has this feud with a rival, and a messenger gets sent back and forth, and no agreement is reached, and then this angry king starts this long rant, and the messenger standing next to him panics because he can't remember that long rant. And then the king of Uruk in Mesopotamia, today's Iraq, takes clay and puts his long rant onto clay and gives it to the messenger, and the messenger takes it to the rival, and the rival is so impressed by writing that he'll submit. So I feel like that's the first text message sent in the history of the world by an angry king. I don't know what that makes you think of. I know what it makes me think of. And so, you know, sending text messages, it is very new, and text has become a verb, but it's also strangely at the very beginning of writing, at least according to this story.
And probably a little longer than Twitter.
Yes.
So, first of all, writing. Tell us, how did writing come about?
Well, it's very hard to say, of course, in retrospect. And that story is in some ways as close as we are going to get, because this is a story Mesopotamian scribes wrote down about how their ancestors had invented writing. And so what's interesting about it is, I think, two things. On the one hand, it has to do with power, right? It's used by one king to impress another. So it's a story about the power of writing. The other thing that's interesting for me is that it has nothing to do with literature. And that's true of early writing, especially in Mesopotamia. It's used by imperial scribes who run a first bureaucracy, really. It's accountants, if you will, who invent writing. And it's only after many hundreds of years that these scribes start to use that accounting technology to do something completely different, and that's to write down a story. It's just a kind of byproduct of this accounting technology, but it's a very powerful byproduct. And it's at this moment when my story really begins, the story of written texts. And so I think of it very much as the intersection, the first intersection of oral storytelling and these new writing technologies. And that origin, in a sense, then also determines the rest of the story I'm telling. Because if literature is the intersection of storytelling, oral storytelling, and writing technologies, that means that if there are changes in writing technologies, that will impact storytelling. And that's exactly what happened. So I track developments like the alphabet or parchment and paper, and of course print, and all these new technologies create profound changes in the way literature works. And that's the red thread that leads me through those 4,000 years all the way to the present.
Red thread? Is that an allusion to the myth of Theseus?
It isn't, but it could be. I like that idea.
Yeah, so you actually start a little bit later than the origin of writing, because you start with Alexander the Great. Why is that?
It's true. And I do that in part because I think that story of Alexander the Great sort of perfectly captured another aspect of the story I wanted to tell, and that is to really show the transformative power of these written stories. I think today when we hear the word literature, a lot of people think of what's on the fiction bookshelf in the bookstore. And that's fine. You know, maybe that's what we buy when we get on a long airplane ride or something like that, but doesn't seem particularly important. But once you expand the notion of literature from contemporary fiction to really important written stories, you get a much broader view, including religious stories, political stories. Talk about the Declaration of Independence, of course, the Bible and other religious stories. So that it's that importance of literature, the shaping power of literature that I was after. So with Alexander the Great, it's a chapter really about Homer and the Homeric epics, but it's also how they were used. So this is the striking thing about Alexander the Great. He grew up like most Greeks at the time who learned how to read and write by studying Homer. But he was so struck by, especially the Iliad, the story of the Trojan War, that it really got hold of his imagination. And when he became king and started his campaign in Asia, he thought that he was basically reenacting the stories of the Iliad, of that much earlier moment when a Greek navy sailed to Asia Minor, to Troy, and captured the city in a 10-year war. The first thing Alexander does when he starts his Asian campaign is he takes Troy, even though it has no political importance. He he starts to reenact scenes from the Trojan War, and he takes his copy of the Iliad with him, and he sleeps on it every night. So it's very clear that that text really fueled his imagination and in some sense fueled the campaign that changed the face of history.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Harvard World Literature professor Martin Puckner about his acclaimed book, The Written World. Yeah, you say it became the basis of really spreading the Greek alphabet throughout the world and thereby changing other people's literature as well.
And right, that's the interesting thing about it. That's the other thing. The other reason why I love the story is because, so on the one hand, you have Homer really influencing, shaping Alexander's mind and inspiring this campaign for better or for worse. But then in a sense, Alexander gives back because it is through his campaign that Greek spreads throughout the East in Asia, and Greek becomes a kind of world language, a lingua franca. And that means, of course, that the best text in Greek, namely Homer, becomes a kind of world text for the first time. And of course, then Alexander builds libraries and theaters, including his successors built the Great Library of Alexandria, and the Homeric epics are sort of the cornerstone of that.
And isn't it ironic because, of course, Homer, if he even existed, which we don't know, never wrote anything down. And in fact, these epics were not even written for hundreds of years until after he died.
Exactly. So this is another example of the importance of oral storytelling throughout the history of literature. It was really surprising to me. I thought, of course, oral storytelling is important for the beginning of literature because that's all literature was before writing. But then I was struck by the fact that oral storytelling really continues to be one of the drivers of literature all the way to the 20th century. As you know, I pair some of the well-known texts like Homer and the Bible with lesser-known texts that I think should be better known. And one of them is the Epic of Sundjata, a West African epic that, much like Homer, commemorates the founding of an empire, in this case, an empire in West Africa that existed during the Middle Ages and that was, again, transmitted like the Homeric epics for hundreds of years, but was only written down in the late 20th century. So what happened in the ancient world with Homer and the Epic of Gilgamesh is still happening today. And that was striking to me. I hadn't been aware of that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're speaking with Martin Puckner about his book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. So speaking of the Epic of Gilgamesh, this was the first literary text. Tell us about the epic. Tell us its story.
It's a fascinating story because, unlike the Homeric epics we just talked about, it is very proud of the fact that it's being written down. There is no writing in the world depicted by Homer, but the Epic of Gilgamesh, the epic that exists in the place where writing was first invented, namely in Mesopotamia, is very proud. So it begins with a tour of the city of Uruk. This is where the epic is set. And it describes the hero, King Gilgamesh, as a writer king. Here's a king who essentially writes his own story. Now, the story of Gilgamesh is an interesting one. It begins with Gilgamesh being a reckless leader who is not responsible, who is only interested in himself, and who through a long and painful journey has to become a more responsible leader. The gods engineer this in part by giving him a companion, a friend, Enkidu, and the Epic of Gilgamesh has many adventures of the two friends going off, defeating monsters, and there are interesting stories connected to that as well. But ultimately, Enkidu dies, and this becomes a real crisis for Gilgamesh, and he almost goes mad, and he looks for eternal life. And it's at this moment that he encounters a creature who doesn't die, someone named Utanapishtim, and it's this person who tells Gilgamesh, King Gilgamesh, the story of the flood. And this is what's so striking about it. It's a story of the flood that is basically identical to what's in Genesis in the Bible. Now, the Epic of Gilgamesh itself disappeared from all knowledge for thousands of years. It was written on clay tablets, which was lucky because when the library in which it was housed burned down, it didn't burn the way it would have if it had been written on paper or parchment, because clay, of course, when it's exposed to fire, gets harder. So it was almost like these tablets on which it had been written were burnt in a kiln. And this is how they survived underground for 2,000 years until they were rediscovered in the 19th century. And when the language was deciphered and the writing system was deciphered, Victorian England, this was in the late 19th century now, discovered to its great surprise that the story of the flood that we know so well from the Bible existed in this much earlier text, hundreds of years before.
But isn't it true that nobody could really at first read the inscriptions because, you know, Alexander had wiped out the knowledge of cuneiform when he brought the Roman alphabet, the Greek alphabet, to the world. So how did it come about that people actually did learn what was in it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So that's the interesting thing, that the alphabet was such a powerful, so much easier to use, that the alphabet displaced these earlier, much more complicated non-alphabetic writing systems almost everywhere, with the exception of East Asia. And so including the cuneiform writing, the complicated writing system on clay that in which the Epic of Gilgamesh was written down, and it was never transliterated into another writing system. So when cuneiform writing fell out of use, the Epic of Gilgamesh disappeared and all knowledge of cuneiform writing disappeared. So, and it took many decades for people at the British Library. So the Epic of Gilgamesh was rediscovered by a British adventurer who brings it to the British Library. But then it takes another couple of decades until a relatively lowly employee at the British Library painstakingly deciphers it. It was a very complicated process. It focused on, because so there was no Rosetta Stone of cuneiform writing. So he basically focused on names. And this is also how Egyptian hieroglyphics were deciphered, because, you know, there are names and they're often similar in various languages and writing systems, and so they're easier to figure out. And once, if you have lists of names or lists of kings, and that's how you can start to slowly piece together how a writing system works. The difficulty was that they also didn't know what language the writing system was representing. So it's a really complicated detective work that happened there. And there are many ancient writing systems that are not deciphered to this day.
For example?
So Linear A is an example in the Mediterranean. So this is an early writing system that existed and that hasn't been deciphered. There is the so-called Indus Valley script, an early writing system of some kind that was used in the Indus Valley in India, though it's not clear whether in their hot debates, whether it's a full writing system, that is a writing system that really represents a full language and all its complexity, or whether it is a sort of a sign system used for very specific purposes. It's hard to say, because in the case of the Indus Valley script, there are only a couple of dozen separate signs that have been found. So there are lots of mysteries about the early writing systems, and it's, you know, maybe we'll figure out some of them in the future.
Stories still to be revealed.
That's right. Yeah. Now, that's the amazing thing, that there are all these stories that may still come to light, because we didn't, in some cases, of course, we know that, you know, there are references to old stories and we know that they existed and that they have been lost. But in the case of the Epic of Gilgamesh, no one didn't even know that it existed. So yes, it's absolutely possible. I would say it's almost certain that there are great works of literature that disappeared and that may, through a fluke, have survived, and that we may find them in the future.
Then you talk about the teachers. And of course, one of the great teachers was Socrates. He never wrote anything down either. And in fact, he was against writing things down. Why is that?
Yeah, that's why I love the story of Socrates, because he is the most explicit about he really spelled out the reasons why he didn't want to write. And so he had a couple of arguments. The first was that it's very easy to take written words out of context. So there's a lot of room for manipulation and misunderstanding. He also worried that you can't ask a text follow-up questions to clarify something. Again, a lot of room for misunderstanding. And then finally, perhaps the most profound argument he made was that once we trust written words, and he almost thought of it like an external storage device outside of our minds, that we would no longer have to know things ourselves, and that we would therefore, our thinking capacities would atrophy. We would become dumber because of writing. Our memories would fail. So those were just a couple of the arguments he made against writing. And he really felt that that room for manipulation, misunderstandings, and even would affect our minds. And I think from Socrates, we can extrapolate that some of these other teachers we talked about, like Jesus or the Buddha or Confucius, that they intuited in similar ways that on the one hand, writing was very powerful. And that was, of course, in evidence all around them. It's the reason why their students would use writing to write down their words. But they also realized that there were real drawbacks to this powerful form of putting words on paper or clay or stone, and that's why they rejected it.
And in fact, I think they're absolutely right in some ways. I mean, I know that ever since the advent of the internet, when I can look phone numbers up instantly in my phone, you know, I've lost the ability to memorize phone numbers.
Absolutely.
But Plato luckily did write down Socrates' words, and the words of the Buddha were written down, or at least stories about him, and of Jesus, of course, and of Muhammad. So what's your perspective on the development of sacred texts that developed so in opposition to the original intention of those who were speaking?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because from one perspective, you could, of course, say that these students are kind of betraying their teachers. They are certainly not doing what the teachers told them to do, namely not to use writing. And as a teacher myself, I'm, of course, not surprised. Students never do what I tell them to do. But, you know, saying that these students kind of betray their teachers is actually putting it much too negatively, because I think these students actually really knew what they were doing. They knew that they were going, in some sense, against their teachers' wishes and intentions. So what they did is they incorporated that into the kinds of texts they were writing. Plato is a good example. So Plato didn't produce a long treatise. He didn't produce a kind of long epic text. He produced a dialogue, a form of drama that really showed Socrates in exchange, in dialogue with his students. And the other students did something very similar. These texts produced by students about teachers who had refused to write are much more vivid. I think of it almost as if the students incorporated some of that oral dramatic life teaching into the kind of literature they were producing. And this is why these texts are quite vivid and read very differently from these other ancient texts we talked about, like the Epic of Gilgamesh or like the Hebrew Bible, these texts that were painstakingly over many centuries assembled by scribes and corrected and edited, whereas these students wrote much quicker, more vividly, and really presented these teachers as these kind of charismatic figures, allowing their readers to almost put themselves at their feet and observe them teach and live as if they were there. So I think that far from actually a betrayal, they did a great service, not just because they preserved these teachers' words, but they, in the process, they produced a new kind of literature, a new very vivid and important text. And that's why I think these texts became so successful. The texts of these written by these students are the foundation of so many of our most important philosophical and religious traditions, including Chinese philosophy and Western philosophy, Indian philosophy, and of course Buddhism and Christianity and Islam. So I think there are lots of reasons, of course, for the success of these intellectual and religious movements, but the power of these texts is one of them.
Well, you talk about textual fundamentalism. What is it, and what's your critique of it?
So, you know, I became very clear to me that I was kind of drawn into my subject and compelled by it in part because of the power of writing and written texts. But perhaps like these teachers we just talked about who rejected writing, I became also very aware of the downside of writing. And especially once written stories were seen as sacred stories and became the kind of foundation for entire cultures. Now, I think there's something great about it, because once you have fixed stories, they can connect us very powerfully to the past. They can orient future generations in important ways. But of course, they are also fixed. And so that raises the big question that I think we still face very much today, because we live in a world shaped by these foundational texts, political texts, religious texts, other texts, namely how to interpret them. Because unlike oral stories are constantly updated, and they're always told in the present for a particular time and place for an audience. That's not true of texts. They're, of course, fixed. So the question is how to interpret them, how to bring these ancient texts into the present and make them work for our own needs and purposes. And this is the great question of how to interpret religious texts, but also how to interpret political texts like our own constitution, right? The debate about the Second Amendment we are having right now is one of those debates. How to make these texts that we want to revere and that are important for cultures that we don't want to just throw over, but we need to allow ourselves the freedom to make them our own, to interpret them in ways that they help us lead our lives today rather than just be fixated on a moment in the past. And I think the unwillingness to do that is what I call textual fundamentalism, namely to insist on a kind of literal and historical reading of these ancient and modern texts without the most important addition, namely to make those texts work for us.
And yet, of course, I would argue that even if you do that, you haven't really solved the problem. I mean, take the Second Amendment. We aired an interview with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who's just written a history of the Second Amendment, in which it's very clear that the Second Amendment was very much reinterpreted in the 1950s and 60s by these extreme right-wingers, Robert Welch and Fred Koch, to make the Second Amendment into something it never was originally intended to be.
You know, that's absolutely right. And that just shows the strangeness of this kind of textual fundamentalism, that it's always in the present, but it pretends that you can somehow go back to an original meaning. And, you know, I totally agree. The Second Amendment is a good example. For so long, it basically just meant well-regulated militia, and then suddenly the so-called individual mandate emerged under the guise of just going back and reading the text literally. I think in the end, a literal and purely historical reading isn't even possible, and it's misguided anyway.
Martin Puckner. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about his book, The Written World, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about the power of the great written stories of world literature to shape people, history, and civilizations. Our guest is Martin Puckner, professor of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. His wonderful book is The Written World. It explores 16 foundational texts selected from more than 4,000 years of world literature, to show how they've helped to shape human civilization. Let's move on to one of my favorite chapters, which was about the first novel, Murasaki and the Tale of Genji. Tell us about that wonderful, wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book, and it's also instructive for us, because I think when I learned literary history, I was still told that the novel as a genre is really a Western invention that was then exported to other parts of the world. Well, as so often, that that turns out not to be the case, because the first great novel was written hundreds of years earlier by this extraordinary lady-in-waiting at the court of Japan around the year 1000. And it's really a great story, in part because, so Murasaki Shikibu, that's the name by which we know her, we don't even know her real name, had to struggle to gain literary fluency. She had to teach herself secretly, because women weren't even supposed to have deep knowledge of, in this case, Chinese literary history. That was the foundation for Japanese literary history as well. So she had to spy on her brother being tutored in Chinese literature and gain her knowledge that way. And soon she was outdoing her brother. And then when she was married early, her husband died, and she acquired this position at court and had this unique position to, in a sense, spy or observe the very secretive doings at the court in Kyoto. So she started to write down what she saw and what was happening around her. And before long, she was writing a novel that was really attuned to the minute machinations of this closed world. She then set the novel 100 years earlier so she wouldn't get into political trouble. But was really fueling this novel was this interest to observe what was going on, to write it down, to think about character motivation, to observe gestures and the whole system of communication at court. It gives us today a unique window into that secret world, and it compelled her contemporaries as well. So it was really everything that we associate with a novel: psychological insight, attention to the social behavior of how characters interact, the whole system at court. All of that we have the pen of this extraordinary woman who really created the first great novel in world history. I love that story, and I think it needs to be better known.
And it also had 800 poems in it. Why was that? And talk about the role of poetry in Japanese society.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Of course, it's true of both Chinese and Japanese literature, that while most other literary traditions begin with these foundational epics that we talked about, the epic of Gilgamesh or the Homeric epics, Chinese literary history really begins with a poetry collection. And because of that, poetry is always seen as the most important form of literature in both in the sort of Sinosphere, in the Chinese influenced countries of East Asia. Now, that was one reason, but there is another reason, and that in this court society, everyday communication was really done by these short written poems. And some of the members of this court society perfected, of course, the writing of these short waka poems and produced beautiful poems, but others didn't, but they wrote them anyway. And at any given day at court, dozens of these poems were exchanged, almost again like text messages. And this is what Murasaki describes in her novel. So the society uses poetry written on paper, a relatively new invention that was really changing the way literature functioned. It was kind of an everyday poetry. I would really describe it to text messages, because there was a protocol how to write them. There's always a question of how quickly do you respond. There were sort of allusions, and the whole society basically communicated that way. And so Murasaki Shikibu included that, of course, in her novel, and many examples, as you mentioned, almost 800 of them in that very long novel. Good luck reading it, by the way.
I must have an abridged copy, because it's not that long.
Okay, no, the original is about 1,000 pages long.
Now, talking about paper, in your discussion of the 1001 Nights, also this, I had no idea that these were actually stories from many, many different places collected over hundreds of years, possibly by Alexander the Great. But you say that paper was the bringing of paper from East Asia to the Middle East was a very critical part of the story of the 1001 Nights.
It was, and that's one of the striking sort of technological stories for me, that paper had this transformative effect. I I was not surprised that print had an important effect. We all know that kind of, but paper did as well, because it lowered the cost of literature. And once you lower the cost, significantly lower the cost of something, important things happen. Suddenly, more people can enter the world of literature. That means literacy rates rise, and that means new kinds of stories get written down, stories that otherwise would only exist in a purely spoken world. And this is precisely what happened once paper was, which was invented in China, moved to the Arabic world. And there are dramatic stories, by the way, of how the secret of paper making arrived in the Arabic world. There are stories of prisoners of war who were tortured. Who knows whether they are true, but I think they show this, these stories show how important paper was seen to be, an important technology. So once paper arrives in the Arabic world, it fuels the golden age of Arab letters. Baghdad becomes the center of papermaking. The Arabs perfect the technique of papermaking, especially making paper out of rags, the technique that was still used up until the 19th century. And so you have, on the one hand, beautiful calligraphic paper versions of the Quran, but you also have the other effect, an explosion really of popular writing. And this is the collection we now know as 1001 Nights or the Arabian Nights is a perfect example of that, because it's that kind of more popular storytelling that existed before and existed from everywhere, from India to Greece, but it now entered the world of writing. It now entered the written world because, in part, paper had lowered the cost of writing, and a kind of rising merchant class is started to get interested in literature and has access to it. And of course, it's often merchants who appear in the Arabian Nights as protagonists. And as you mentioned, there was really a kind of continent-spanning network of stories that were circulating from India, in Persia, in the Arabic world, and all the way to southern Europe with Greece. And these collectors used these stories, they adapted them, they collected them, and produced these fantastic story collections, often adding these frame stories to them. That was the great innovation, where you, of course, have Shahrazad and the king, and she has to survive by telling stories from cliffhanger to cliffhangers. There are other frame stories. So that becomes a new form of literature, these framed story collections, and they really take over in the late antiquity and the Middle Ages, and are so popular that even individual authors like Chaucer or Boccaccio start to imitate these story collections and start to write stories, sometimes using some of these existing stories, sometimes inventing new ones, but acting as if these were just collected stories, like in the Arabian Nights. So that becomes a real innovation and a big success.
So by frame tale, you mean, you know, there is a narrator who collects these stories. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. So there's a scene in which, you know, in the Canterbury Tales, it's just pilgrims on their way to Canterbury. So there's a sort of a frame, a narrator, storyteller, who then tells stories, and then you go into the stories. In the Arabian Night, of course, there's a particular drama to that frame story, because Shahrazad, the female narrator of these stories, has spent a night with the king, and the king has been driven mad by his wife's infidelity. So he had sworn that he would only spend one night with a woman and then put her to death. That's the crazy, dramatic frame of the Arabian Nights. And so Shahrazad is given to the king, or in fact offers herself to the king, because she has this plan, this storytelling plan. And then after spending a night with the king, she asks him, before she would be put to death, can she tell him a story? And that she starts to tell the first story. And the king is so compelled that he wants to hear the end of it. So she survives one night, and then the next night, and the next night, and so on and so forth. And there are stories within stories within stories. So it's a real labyrinth of stories. But all through this time, we are going from cliffhanger to cliffhanger. And we know that if there's not enough suspense, our narrator will die. But what's interesting about it is that Shahrazad not only survives, she also manages to cure the king by the end. So these stories are entertaining, they are wonderful, they are thrilling, but they also have a pedagogical function, and they often revolve around rulers, bad rulers and good rulers. And from night to night, the more stories the king hears, the more he is somehow snaps out of his murderous madness, especially with regard to women. And by the end, he's cured.
It's so interesting. I mean, somebody had to put the frame around the collection, don't you think? In fact, I think you went looking for her, and then you had a remarkable dream which told you maybe not to look for her. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, because I'm curious why a woman would be the originator of these stories, which really do revolve around saving the life of a woman in a culture that really didn't privilege women all that much.
That's right, and it's really striking. Now there is a sense that the framing story Scheherazade, it's a Persian name, so there are lots of indications that that frame story may be of Persian origins, and there is in fact a Persian collection of stories that were partially used for this Arabic story collection, so that you can go back to that origin. But then a lot of stories from that Persian story collection come from India, and there are these great Indian story collections. And so I realized that it is basically impossible to find a single origin, because these stories really existed everywhere. There is this sea of stories. There's an Indian story collection that's called the sea, the ocean of stories. And that's what it feels like. And there isn't a single origin, but there are these different collectors who put together these collections. They borrow stories from each other. They adapt them. You can see that when a story moves from India to Persia to Greece, the substance of the story remains the same, but say the animals, if it's animal stories, the animals change because they're different animals in India and in Persia and Greece. So you can see them transform and morph into each other. And the most fascinating chapter in the case of the Arabian Nights, to me, happens in the 18th century when the story collection arrives in Europe and takes Europe by storm. First France, because there's a French translator. And the story collection becomes so successful in France that people demand more and more stories to be translated. And the story collector translates more and more stories, but then he runs out of stories. So what does he do in his desperation? He finds a Syrian storyteller, and he basically tells the Syrian storyteller to come up with new stories. And some of the best known stories from the Arabian Nights, such as Aladdin, Ali Baba, they are from that Syrian storyteller from the 18th century. Now, the Syrian storyteller used some existing stories and combined them in new ways and invented certain aspects of them. So he wasn't making it all up. But in some sense, the Arabian Nights continued to evolve through the 18th century, through this interesting contact between East and West. And that's the great thing about these story collections, that they're not never finite. You can always add them and retell these stories in new ways. And of course, that's what we've been doing with them ever since.
And you're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Harvard World Literature Professor Martin Puckner about his acclaimed book, The Written World: The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. Well, we haven't mentioned, and I'd like to, in the time that we have left, you know, the other great invention, well, I think you did mention it, but we didn't talk about it, and that is the invention of printing in a modern form. Originally, you point out, it was another invention of the Chinese using woodblock printing, but I'm talking about the invention of Johannes, that wasn't his real name, but we call him Johannes Gutenberg. Talk about how that came about. Tell us the story of how the invention of printing came about.
Yeah. You know, we often think that inventions or inventors have this sort of one breakthrough idea and then everything follows from that. And in the case of Gutenberg, and I think in many other cases, that's often not true. Now, as you mentioned, Gutenberg was not the first to think of print, even of print with movable type. That too had been done in East Asia way before Gutenberg. And so Gutenberg, living in the city of Mainz in Northern Europe, a city well known for long distance trade, was in a good position to have heard something about East Asian printing, including with movable type. But he was really an entrepreneur. He started to collect funds and set up a secret society very carefully to develop, because he sensed that there's something that could be done with print, that the process was very rarely used and it was awkward and primitive. And he felt that there was much more that could be done with this East Asian way of printing with movable type. So he went and basically rethought the entire process. He invented a way, had many little inventions along the way, for example, how to mass produce individual letters, because he knew that he needed to mass produce letters if he wanted to mass produce books. And he used something that was ubiquitous in the wine region in which he lived, namely he used a wine press to press paper onto print. And paper, of course, was the other thing that he really needed. And he was lucky that the Arabs had introduced paper to Europe via the Arab-occupied part of Spain, Al-Andalus, just a few hundred years before Gutenberg. So paper was available as a cheap material in which to print. So all of this meant that Gutenberg, after experimenting for about a decade, had really revolutionized the way print could be used. And of course, the first great work he printed was the Latin Bible. But it wasn't a single breakthrough ideas. It was more a series of tweaks and of rethinking the whole process. In a sense, Gutenberg set up the first sort of industrial mass production process, and he perfected it, and he assembled the capital used for it, and he found a client, namely the church. So I came away from the story thinking that he was much more like a Steve Jobs, say, who's sort of an entrepreneur who uses someone else's invention but realizes that something new can be made with it, than an inventor who has this one idea and then, you know, develops it.
Yeah, well, he didn't just print the Bible. He actually first started out by printing indulgences, which led to a huge explosion of the sale of indulgences, which led to Martin Luther, who I would say was kind of like the bloggers of today. So tell us, how did that progression happen?
Yeah, that's very nicely put. So it's one of the, you know, the history is full of ironies, and this is one of them, that one of the first clients of the church, the early adopter of print, was the church, A, for their printed Bibles, and they were delighted that Gutenberg could produce Latin Bibles much more cheaply and more beautifully than handwriting was ever able to do. But they also thought it was even better for indulgences, because indulgences were just a one page. And, you know, you have a Latin text and the name of the person who buys the indulgence would be left free. And then you can just print page after page. And the church produced huge print runs of these indulgences very cheaply, sometimes thousands, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of these indulgences, almost like printing money. So for about 60, 70 years, the church couldn't have been more pleased with this new invention of print. But then, ironically, it is the very success of these indulgences that riles up Martin Luther, this very otherworldly friar who knows nothing, who is not interested in print. He writes his 95 theses by hand in church Latin and sends it to the bishop. There's no response, but then suddenly he's kind of gets drawn into this polemical fight with the church, and then some of his friends suggest that he might use print, and so he begins to print his attacks against the church, and he switches from Latin into German, and with print, suddenly this thing takes off, and by the end of his life, a full third of all texts printed in Germany are by Martin Luther. He becomes the master of this new mass medium. And so, like the bloggers of today, I think you're absolutely right. So it's of course something the church didn't foresee, didn't intend, but the very success of print and this early alliance of print and the church falls apart and it becomes clear that this new world of mass production, what matters not so much is institutional power, which of course the church has, but that this new era of mass literacy plays by different rules, and that an individual friar like Martin Luther, who has a way with words and who has the power of print behind him, can take on the most powerful institution on earth.
Yeah, and maybe that's the most salient message for today as we deal in a world of, on the one hand, fake news, and on the other hand, I mean, the very fact that I can do this program and I can have it broadcast all across the country and podcasted all across the world, and I don't need anybody else to, you know, tell me whether I can do it or not. There's no gatekeepers. You know, that's the positive aspect of it, and the negative aspect is fake news. So after having written this wonderful book, The Written World, Martin Puckner, what's maybe the most important lesson you feel we need to take away from the book?
I think it goes along the lines of what you've just said, because there were worries and panics about the changing technologies every time they happen. It happened with paper. It happened with print. There, you know, the church would say there's a lot of fake news out there, and it's true. It became kind of wild because institutions no longer controlled what was being printed. So there are lots of worries about these transformations, and it was always clear that changes in writing technologies change the way we use written words, and that has a profound impact. But I think what happened at these earlier moments, that after a while, a kind of new equilibrium gets established. And I think that's what happened with print. There was a lot of fake news in the early days and early decades and even centuries of print. But also wonderful things happened. Scholarly society were established. Encyclopedias emerged. Science, as we know it, really went hand in hand with print and the distribution of information. And new hierarchies of reputation with reputable newspapers and less reputable newspapers emerged. And so I would describe it as a kind of equilibrium emerged around this new technology. And I'm having seen that happen in the past. I am cautiously optimistic that the same is happening around us. I mean, we're just at the beginning of the age of the internet. And yes, everything is moving very fast, but it may take a while for new forms of authority and so on to be established around the internet. And I think even, you know, every day in the newspaper, you see how Facebook and others are trying to figure this out. It will take a while. There's no doubt about it. But in the past, these new technologies and the revolutions they brought with them ended up transforming things, but the worst fears didn't come to pass. And you know, if you asked someone in the church around 1600, they would have thought that something terrible is going to happen, but then new things emerged. And so I am cautiously optimistic, but it may take a while. And it mean, and, you know, we can't trust the technology. We have to use them. We have to make use of them and make the best use that we can. And I think you, with your podcast, are part of that.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And this has been just a fascinating discussion about your fascinating book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, Civilization. Martin Puckner, thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for the conversation.
Martin Puckner is the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. Read an excerpt from The Written World at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.